So in our last lecture, we've established that Mishneh Torah, that this book, that the book of Dvarim, Deuteronomy, that the rabbis called Mishneh Torah because it repeats the Torah all over again, doesn't exactly repeat the Torah all over again. For example, we've seen that when it repeats the law, it doesn't repeat the entire body of the law. There are many missing pieces, and an important missing piece is that most of the korbanot, most of the sacrifices, which were in Leviticus, don't reappear in Deuteronomy. We saw the same thing in the narrative, that the building of the tabernacle is a major part of the narrative, and it's barely present when the narrative repeats itself in Deuteronomy. In some way, he takes the sacrifice out of the law and the tabernacle out of the story, out of the narrative. I want to add another layer to that today, and that is the way he treats details, the details of sacrifice. Now, in the world of sacrifice of Leviticus, it's very clear that the two most important parts that you're supposed to put on the altar, the most important sacred parts of the body of the animal that you locate on the altar, is the dam v'chelev, the blood and the suet, or the fats. Those are the parts that you offer to God. And interestingly enough, this is how, when he goes into that, just in one line, this is how he repeats those details. I'm reading now from Deuteronomy 12, verse 27, where he says, "Vasita olotecha, habasar vehadam al mizbeach, mizbeach Adonai Elohecha, vedam zvachecha yishapech al mizbeach Adonai Elohecha, vehabasar tochal." You have to pour the blood on the altar and you eat the meat. Now in Leviticus it says you put the blood and the fats. And here it says only the blood. Does the book of Deuteronomy, is he reforming sacrifice here? Is he changing the ritual? Is he saying that from now on the fats are not supposed to go on the altar, only the blood? I know it seems like it's a small detail, but this is a big deal. According to Prophet Ezekiel, the fats and the blood, or the, symbolically speaking, the foods of God. This is emphasized and re-emphasized in the book of Leviticus. And then when he repeats it, it's only the blood, not the fats. What's going on here? I do not think he's reforming ritual. I do not think he's canceling that detail. It's a small detail. And I think that's exactly the point. I think the book of Deuteronomy thinks this is just a small detail. This is another testimony. The fact that he mentions the blood and not the fats, it's because he doesn't go into details. He's kind of indifferent to details. He's kind of indifferent to the whole world of rituals and sacrifice to begin with. And this ritualistic indifference is what we've tried to establish and tell now. And I think this point, on thinking about the fats that are not mentioned, seeing this is a small, irrelevant detail, establishes the ritualistic indifference of the book of Deuteronomy. What does this all mean? What is the fact that he barely mentions the tabernacle, the sacrifices are absent, he's indifferent to details? What does this mean? Well, there is a problem. The problem is that there is another textual move, a parallel textual move in the book of Deuteronomy that seems to be in tension with this move. And this is a very important textual move in the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy is the first book to centralize the sacrifice, centralize worship. In the book of Deuteronomy, it starts in chapter 12, it says that we're not allowed to worship God through sacrifice in any place besides the place that God has chosen. For example, in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 5, it says, "Ki im el hamakom asher yivchar Adonai Elohechem mikol shivtechem lasum et shmo sham lishichno tidreshu uvata shama." Later on, in verse 11, it will say, "Vahiyah hamakom asher yivchar Hashem Elohechem bo lishkon shmo shama shama taviu et kol asher anochim et zevetchem olotechem vezifrechem asrotechem." So he's saying there'll be one place, and only one place, we are supposed to offer sacrifices. We are supposed to worship God through rituals and through sacrifice. Only one place. Now, the reason why this is a dramatic change is because until this moment, until Deuteronomy, the understanding was you'll have to worship God through sacrifice everywhere as long as it's in the land of Israel. That's how the book of Judges understood it. That's how the book of Samuel understood it. That's how the people in the desert understood it. And then the book of Deuteronomy changes everything. King Josiah, by the way, was the king that found this book and canceled all the temples which are not the temple in Jerusalem because he tried to implement this important central message of the book, which is the centralization of sacrifice. You're not allowed to worship God anywhere besides the temple, besides the place that God has chosen. Now, this move seems like a move that glorifies the temple. The temple has a monopoly over worship. You're not allowed to worship any other place. So it seems like the temple is extremely important. The place that God has chosen, in the words of Deuteronomy, is extremely important for Moshe and for Deuteronomy. So how do you somehow reconcile between the fact that he's indifferent to sacrifice, but he's not indifferent to the place, that God has chosen? He's not indifferent to the temple. How do you reconcile the fact that he is so indifferent to sacrifice and at the same time glorifies the place of sacrifice? This is the problem I want to address today. These two moves in Deuteronomy that seem to be to conflict each other. And in order to understand this, I think we have to understand a different question. Where is God in the book of Deuteronomy? When the book of Deuteronomy remembers the event on Mount Sinai, he tells a story differently. Now, the way it's told in Exodus is that in some way God appeared on Mount Sinai. Vayered Adonai be'anan vayityatsev imo sham. This is the motif that repeats itself in the book of Exodus, that God somehow comes down, maybe from the sky, appears in a form or within a cloud. Maybe it's symbolic, maybe not. But God somehow comes down to Mount Sinai. He appears in some mysterious way on Mount Sinai. That's what happened according to Exodus. And then from the cloud, from where God revealed himself, that's where he spoke. That's where they heard his voice. That's where they heard the Ten Commandments. That's life according to the book of Exodus. But in Deuteronomy, when it remembers what happened in Mount Sinai, it has a different memory. This is what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 36. Min hashamayim hishmi'acha et kolo. Liyasrecha ve'al ha'aretz her'echa et isho ha'gdola. V'dvarav shamata mitoch ha'esh. On the mountain you saw fire, but his voice didn't come from the fire. God was in the sky, and his voice came from the sky through the fire to your ears. So in Exodus, God appears. God came down from the sky. In Deuteronomy, God stayed in the sky. God did not come down to this world in the revelation. He did not appear on the mountain. So Exodus and Deuteronomy locate God in a different place, at least the way they describe the revelation on Mount Sinai. And this takes us to an important question. If God didn't come down to Mount Sinai, did he come down in some way and present himself in the tabernacle and later on in the temple? According to the book of Leviticus, yes, that's exactly what happens. According to the book of Leviticus, and by the way, also the book of Exodus, God somehow is present in the Holy of Holies. In the Holy of Holies, there is the Ark, and above the Ark, there is a piece of gold called the Kaporet, and out of the Kaporet, the two cherubs come out, and somehow between those cherubs, there's a cloud, and that cloud represents God's presence. Ki be'anan ira'e. God is somehow present there. God is somehow calling Moses from within the Holy of Holies, according to the book of Leviticus. Somehow, in some symbolic, metaphoric, or mysterious way, God is present in the tabernacle and therefore later on in the temple. What is the understanding of the book of Deuteronomy, the same book that doesn't think that God was present in Sinai, does that book think that God was present in somehow in the tabernacle? There's a very interesting insight into the theology of the book of Deuteronomy. It appears later on in chapter 26 of book of Deuteronomy, where they describe what later rabbis will call Maaser Sheni. When you bring your fruit offerings to Jerusalem, to enjoy them in Jerusalem. So you enter the temple, the tabernacle or the temple, and there is a text that you're supposed to say as a part of that ritual. And here's the text, I'll read it to you. You start praying to God and you say, Hashkifa mim'on kodshecha. You're asking God to observe you, mim'on kodshecha, from where God dwells, min hashamayim, in the sky, uvarech et amcha Yisrael, ve'et ha'adama asher matat lanu kasher nishbata la'avoteinu eretz zavat chalav u'dvash. So you ask God, please bless us from where you are in the sky and bless our land, our ground on this earth, Eretz Yisrael. So there's a move here where you enter the tabernacle and you bless God and recognizing that God is in the sky. Now let's notice what's interesting about this ritual. You enter the tabernacle because that's where God is. And the text that you say is, recognizes that God is not here. God is in the sky. There's a contradiction between the ritual and the text, between what you do and what you say. You enter the tabernacle as if it's God's place, and you say, by the way, I know this is not God's place. This paradoxical ritual, which is captured in one verse here, is amplified in one of the rituals that I think captures the deepest understanding of the theology of Deuteronomy. That is the ritual practiced by King Solomon when he founded the first temple. And this is in, if anybody wants to see, in Kings 1, chapter 8. We're in Kings 1, chapter 8. After King Solomon builds the temple, there's a big ceremony, a big festival. They just built the temple. They just built God's house, so to speak. And now that they build God's house, now there is a moment where somehow God is supposed to move in. That's what happened in Exodus. God somehow moved in. And now Solomon is supposed to celebrate the moment where God is going to somehow shrink his presence, his existence, and enter the house he's just built. So during this ceremony, this exciting ceremony, King Solomon delivers a speech. And in his speech, there's this line, the following line. He says, Ki ha'umnam yeshev Elohim al ha'aretz? Do you think God would really sit on the earth? Hine ha'shamayim ushmei ha'shamayim lo yechalkelucha af ki ha'bayit hazeh asher baniti. Ha'shamayim ushmei ha'shamayim. The sky and the skies of the sky cannot contain God. Also this house can't. Again, the paradox. Again, the conflict between the action and the text. The action, he builds God's house, and then the text is, by the way, this is not God's house. The entire cosmos cannot contain God. Also, this house is not going to contain God. What does it mean when there is a gap between your action and your awareness? What Solomon does, he amplifies the internal tension of the book of Deuteronomy, where you go to the tabernacle, and you say a text that recognizes that God is not in the tabernacle. Hashkifa mim'on kodshecha, min ha'shamayim. Let's try to put this together. A very important change, a very important interpretation, a very important revolution, you might say, to be found in the book of Deuteronomy, is the idea that God is not present in the temple. He's not present in the tabernacle. He wasn't there on Sinai, and he's not inside a box inside the tabernacle. That's the theology of Deuteronomy. So it turns out there's a triple move here. Move number one, taking sacrifice out of his speech. Move number two, centralizing sacrifice in God's place, in the place that God chose. And then he takes God out of that place. Now, why would you centralize sacrifice in one place and then take God out of that place? You would think it's the other way around, right? Because you believe that God is there, that's why only there you could worship God. But that's not the move of Deuteronomy. The move of Deuteronomy is, I would say that it's unexplained is an understatement. Takes God out of the temple and then say only in the temple you could worship God. So what's going on here? There's another mitzvah in the book of Leviticus that appears twice in Leviticus and not even once in Deuteronomy. It's called Morah Mikdash. It's Mikdashi Tirau. We're supposed to have awe. We're commanded to have awe towards the temple or the tabernacle. That doesn't exist in Deuteronomy. The book that centralized the sacrifice in the temple erased the commandment to have awe for the temple. What's going on here? I'd like to try to put this together, and I want to be guided by the Rambam here, by Maimonides, by a very interesting point that Rambam makes in the Guide for the Perplexed, Volume 3, Chapter 32. So in this chapter, Rambam asks the question, why is it that you can only worship God in one place? Is it because this place is so important? Is it because it's more so sacred? Is it because it's closer to God? Like Deuteronomy, also Rambam thought that the answer to all that is no. It's not because this place is closer to God than any other place. It's not because God is more present there than any other place. So why only here can you worship God? And Rambam's surprising answer is that the purpose of centralizing ritual in one place is to minimize the opportunities to practice sacrifice. You see, it's not about lifting the temple. It's about minimizing sacrifice. It's not me. This is Maimonides, Volume 3, Chapter 32 of The Guide for the Perplexed. And to understand the way Rambam understands this, we have to try to imagine the reality created in the day-to-day life for people after the centralization of sacrifice in one place. See, before centralization of sacrifice, before this revolution of the book of Deuteronomy, so people worship God through sacrifice everywhere. Actually, every time people wanted to eat meat, so what they did was they took part of the meat, the blood, the fats, they put it on the altar in their local tribe, their local neighborhood, their local altar. So they symbolically shared their food with God. They shared their sandwich with God, symbolically speaking. Every time they wanted to eat meat, they had to make a sacrifice to God. And that way, religious rituals were everywhere. Sacrifice was everywhere. And because it's possible everywhere, it happens all the time. It was a part of their life. It was a very intensive life, religiously speaking. Now when you centralize worship, when you centralize sacrifice, we are only allowed to offer sacrifice in one place. It doesn't only mean that sacrifice is in one place and not in all the places. It also means it's only in certain times and not all the time. It's a different experience of time where your day today is now empty from sacrifice. So centralization of sacrifice empties the rest of the world, the rest of the land, from sacrifice. So one might say, and this is the great observation, one of the most important scholars of the book of Deuteronomy, Moshe Weinfeld, that effectively speaking, the centralization of the cult, of the sacrifice, was a secularization of all the places and times outside of the temple and outside of the high holidays, which means your daily life became secular. You're eating meat and not offering it to God. Your life is now empty from religious rituals. So centralization of the cult is a secularization of life. So now, maybe one way to think about this, I know this is a bad example, but I'll say it anyway, because it will help us think about this. Theodor Herzl in Altneuland. He has a vision for the relationship between church and state, or synagogue and state, or rabbis and law in the future Jewish state. And he says that the best way to deal with rabbis and religion and separate religion from state is by building synagogues. That way, the rabbis will stay in the synagogues and they won't be a part of the public sphere. This is Herzl. He says, just like the armies have to stay in their bases, and synagogues will, and rabbis will stay in the synagogues, so that's how you can have a healthy liberal democracy. If the army stays in their bases, it won't be a militant society. If rabbis will stay in their synagogues, it won't be a theocracy. This is Herzl's thinking, that not by erasing synagogues you protect the state from interference of religion, but by building synagogues, you protect the state from the interference of religion. I know this is a very loaded example, but I think this is exactly what Maimonides is thinking about the book of Deuteronomy. That the way to minimize sacrifice is by centralizing sacrifice and somehow locking it in one place. So let's try to put everything we did so far together in four moves. Move number one, he repeats a story, takes a sacrifice out of the law. Move number two, he repeats a story and takes the ark and the tabernacle out of the narrative. Move number three, centralizes sacrifice in one place. And move number four, takes God out of that place. And what are we left with? We're left with sacrifice out of the law and sacrifice out of life, out of the daily life, creating a Judaism for ordinary people, with no sacrifice. It's not a part of their past, of their memory, and it's not a part of their presence. Now, what's the meaning of all this? First of all, I don't know. This is a big question, how the book of Deuteronomy changes Judaism. How it offers, it's symbolic that my kippah just fell off. It's a big question, how does it change Judaism? Why is it taking sacrifice out of the law, out of the narrative, and out of life? Why is it doing that? Does it have a secular vision for Judaism? I don't think so. Because then there is the fifth move of Deuteronomy, and it's the following move. It says that once the people of Israel enter Israel, they have to take the words that he's saying today and carve it on a rock. And it says that once every 7 years, the people of Israel have to gather together. And one person, Chazal understanding as the king, have to read these words to them. They have to read these words to them once every 7 years, the entire book. But also he says to them, V'hayu hadvarim ha'ele, these words should be on your heart. And v'shinantam lebanecha, and you should repeat them. When you walk, when you sleep, when you wake up, all day, every day. What has to be everywhere is the dvarim, is the words. V'hayu hadvarim ha'ele. In some way, sacrifice shrinks to one place, but language, words, has to be a part of every place. The move of Deuteronomy is that ritual shrinks, but language, religious language, expands. Now, what does it mean that life is filled not with sacrifice, but with words? What does that mean? I want to think about that more in our next lecture. But for now, I want to reflect on the religious psychology created by the book of Deuteronomy. I want to notice the book of Deuteronomy did not cancel ritual. It did not cancel sacrifice. It just minimized it in the past. It minimizes its presence in the present. That's all it does. It minimizes it. It puts it in its place, in a limited place, but it still has a place. I want to use the book of Psalms to help me understand the role of religious rituals according to Deuteronomy. And the book of Psalms, I want to use Psalms chapter 50 and Psalms chapter 51. So Psalms, Tehillim, chapter 50, there's a great, great critique on sacrifice. For example, as he says, Lo al zvachecha ochichecha. He says, your rituals, your zvachim, that's not what you're judged for. That's not how I measure you, God says to the people. Just like many prophets, sacrifice is not what's really important for God. And he says, Lo ikach mibetecha par mimichleotecha atudim. Ki li kol chayto yar behemot ba'ari elef. Im irav lo omar lach. Ki li tevelum lo'a. He's saying, if I'm ever hungry, God says, like this is a parody, I'm not going to ask you, don't think that you're feeding me when you're offering rituals. Don't think that I'm hungry and I need your sacrifice to eat. I don't need your sacrifice, God says to the people in chapter 50 of Psalms. The same idea was repeated in, we found in Isaiah, in Hosea, in Jeremiah. But the interesting thing is after this anti-ritual, anti-sacrifice chapter, this is how the chapter ends. Zvach le'Elohim toda v'shalem le'Elyon nedarecha v'kar'eni b'yom tzara achaltzecha v'techabdeni. After he attacks ritual, he says to the people, but don't forget to offer your zevach and your toda, these important sacrifices. So after he attacks rituals, he still commands rituals. So it seems like the tension we find in Deuteronomy, we find again in Psalms chapter 50. Psalms 51 has a similar move. Psalms 51 again attacks sacrifice from a different point of view. He says, "Ki lo tachpot zevach v'tena ola lo tirtze." God doesn't want zevach and ola. God is not interested in sacrifice. And he says something beautiful when it comes to religious psychology. He says, "Zivchei Elohim ruach nishbera." The real sacrifice that God wants is not what we offer on the altar. It's our broken hearts. God wants our soul, not the animals that we're sacrificing. Zivche Elohim ruach nishbera, lev nishbar v'nidke, Elohim lo tivze. The Chassidut did a lot with these verses, that God wants our broken hearts, not the sacrifices that we put on the altar. And then how does he end this chapter? He says, Heitiva birtzonchai tzion tivne chomot Yerushalayim az tachfotz zivchei tzedek ola v'chalil az ya'alu al mizbachecha parim. But in the end of days, when the temple is built, we'll come back and we'll put sacrifices on the altar. So the same chapter that criticizes rituals and sacrifice has a fantasy that one day, the temple will be built and we will again offer sacrifice. So again, the tension of Deuteronomy repeats itself. You criticize the world of sacrifice, but then you're aware of the fact you still have to offer sacrifice. What does this all mean? Well, I'd like to offer one thought, and with this to conclude. Religious rituals have a lot of value, even in the book of Deuteronomy, and for chapter 50 and 51 of Psalms, and for Hosea and for Yeshayahu, all the prophets, the writers, and the poets that criticized sacrifice did not cancel sacrifice. They said they still have value. But it seems like their value comes only after you criticize them. Only after you recognize that they have limited value. It's as if once you recognize that rituals have limited value, then rituals start having value. Maybe a way to think about this and to understand this is that because religious rituals have value, they might be abused. They might be overused. They say that if you drink one glass of wine a day, it's healthy for you. You read this every day in the newspaper. Doctors always like to say this. A glass of red wine a day is healthy for you. I hope that's also true about one shot of scotch a day, that's healthy for you. And then one would say, well, if one glass of wine is healthy, then 9 glasses of wine must be very healthy. Because if one is good, 9 is great. And that's a way we think sometimes, that if something is good, so more of it is much better. But the psychology of sometimes more is less is true about religion too. Religious rituals have value only if you recognize that its value is limited. But because it has value, your mind could be seduced to turn to shrink all your religious and spiritual life into rituals. And when it has all the value, it loses its value. The book of Deuteronomy is not a book that cancels sacrifice. cancels ritual, but it limits it. It limits it in space, limits it in time, limits it, shrinks its part of the narrative, and shrinks its part in memory. But it still sustains it, maybe trying to say that religious rituals have value only if they don't have all of the value. That was my spiel today. We live in the future. That's one thing we know. We know that there is a future, and there's a second thing we know. We know we can't control the future. And the combination of those understandings creates constant existential anxiety.